Thank you very much, and thank you for the organizers for the opportunity to give a talk here. This talk is actually named being an overview of sort of what's now a pretty broad area. And in fact, most of what I'm going to be saying is not due to me, so I wanted to list a lot of sort of the seminal papers in this area. And Martijn Weinholt, Chris Herzog, David Berenstein, Douglas Aspinwall, Larian Melnikov, Sheldon Katz, and there's also been a lot of math work on the subject, and sort of the main intersection is the work of Tom Bridgeland. So the goal is to start with a Calabi-Yau cone, which will be some 5-manifold in the radial direction. We'll have the metric. Like this. And we want to ask, what is the gauge theory on a D-brain at the tip of this cone? This has a large number of applications. First of all, this is one of the ways we can understand singularities in string theories by probing them with D-brains. We can take this setup, we can look at the near horizon limit, we'll get ADS5 cross M5, so this is a tool of coming up with new examples of gauge geometry duality. Has come up in model building, and my personal one I like is that it allows you to use a lot of fun mathematics to do things in string theory. So to answer this question, I should say, by the way, that since I've made this to be an overview talk, and I really appreciate lots of questions, and maybe I might even be able to answer some of them. So we'll start with what we know. Orbifolds. So orbifolds are the mildest type of singularity, and from the point of the world sheet, they're not singular at all, so it's a good way we can get a feel for what we should expect for worse singularities. I'm just going to start with a cartoon, which isn't meant to be taken too seriously, though of course it can be made rigorous. We'll just start with a toy model of a Z2 singularity, which is just reflection along some plane here. We want to look at a D3 brain, so it'll be some non-compact thing, so we'll just represent it as a point here. And the way we would describe this is we have a D3 brain and an image brain. And so as we move this to the singular locus, the D3 brain and its image go here, and on the singular locus, all of a sudden it looks like we have two brains. And these brains are free to move up and down along the singularity, but they're stuck. It's only when we bring them together that they become a D3 brain that we can pull off the singularity. So these we will call fractional brains, because in some sense they're fractions of this D3 brain. So let's draw a dot, say, to represent all the fractional brains. Let's choose three of them because it allows me to make a nicer picture. We can then compute the strings, the massless string modes, between the fractional brains, which we will draw, say, as arrows in this diagram. And we can compute the scattering amplitude, or disk amplitude, say, of and this will give rise to some superpotential. So for the case of orbifolds, particular C2 mod gamma for some finite subgroup of SU2, this was done by Douglas and Moore. And in this language, what they found was a fractional brain for each irreducible representation of this finite group. And the quiver ends up being the extended Dinkin diagram, and it has n equals 2 supersymmetry. So each of the arrows corresponds to Carl here, and then you have the vector that corresponds to the hyper. So the quiver will end up looking like and so this was all worked out in the context of orbifolds by Douglas and Moore. So I want to draw some lessons from this story. One, point-like brains at singularities break up into collections of fractional brains. Which are fixed at the singularity. And actually this word break up into, I'm going to now change to, is marginally unstable to decay into. Two. We compute massless strings between the fractional brains to get arrows in the quiver. And three, we compute disk amplitudes to get the superpotential. And we do this, we've got a pretty good handle on what the gauge theory is for this D-brain located at the singularity. Of course, this has been done. I mean, for orbifolds, we're able to do it because we understand string theory at orbifolds. But for more general singularities, we might not really know what to do. So presented with a problem like this, let's lower expectations. And notice that these things we're actually computing. We haven't computed everything about the gauge theory. We've computed what I might call sort of holomorphic aspects of the gauge theory. We have the massless sector, the chiral multiplets, and the superpotential for the chiral multiplets. And in particular, it turns out this does not depend on what we've computed here does not depend on the Kähler moduli of the cone. So we can vary the Kähler moduli and resolve the singularity. And if we do the calculations in the resolved geometry, which is completely non-singular now, so we have a much better idea how to handle things, and just, you know, focus on the superpotential and the massless parts of the gauge theory and the fields in the gauge theory, we can actually now do the calculation. Yeah? So, which was exactly my next point. That's a good question. I mean, really, right? I mean, what you're really describing is some sort of UV theory, and the, you know, you want to sort of pass to the IR, right? So similar with the conifold. So I'm not sure you've really got a handle on these things. Sorry? I would think so, yeah. I mean, right, as I said, from the point of view of this talk, I'm really going to give you, be only able to give you the holomorphic parts of the gauge theory. This is now for more general singularities. I mean, any threefold singularity has a Krepend resolution, so you can resolve it into a non-singular geometry. And it will turn out that's actually not unique, and this non-uniqueness will be interesting, actually. Well, I mean, in fact, the new degrees of freedom, right, are the fractional brains, right? So that's what we're going to try to compute. What are the fractional brains? I think what we're gonna end up at, so in the full string theory, we're gonna have a set of each of the fractional brains will have some central charge in the four-dimensional geometry, and all the phases will be aligned, but they'll all be non-zero. This is the same thing in orbifolds. You can do this exact same story in the orbifold case. You in orbifolds you have these, right? Sorry. I'm not entirely sure. I have to think about it a little carefully. Right now, my goal is just right now to find the fractional brains and compute the disk amplitudes and compute the states between the fractional brains. There isn't. Once I resolve the geometry, everything is nice and non-singular. Right, everything is just stretching between fractional brains. Okay, good. So now just to go back to the very first question Chamath asked, when you resolve the singularity, it does change the question of what brains decay into other brains. And that's actually a very interesting phenomenon that I will actually get back to later on in the talk. So, good. So the main point is that since we're only interested in these holomorphic questions, we can actually do all these calculations in the topological B model. So, I don't want to give a whole lecture on what the topological B model is, but I want to summarize the properties that we're going to be using. So, what one does is one starts with an n equals 2 sigma model on the world sheet. You can do a topological twist of this and then couple it to topological gravity. So it is, in some sense, a string theory that has string amplitudes, closed string and open string amplitudes. But the resulting theory you get on the Kähler structure of the target. Two. Simpler than the full string theory. And generally, one is only dealing with finite dimensional spaces. There's many fewer modes to worry about. But even though it's simpler, we can often take calculations in the topological B model and map them into calculations in the full string. And this is perhaps maybe the most important. We know, or we're pretty sure we know, all the D brains. And this is really actually explicit. It's been pretty hand-wavy in some points, but now we've reached a point where we can really explicitly write down all the D brains in the D model. And there's some subset of them, the stable ones, which will then survive to becoming brains in the full string theory. Any two brains? So given any two brains, you can there's just a vector space that describes the B model states between them. And this state has a grading, and it's graded by what I'll call ghost number. For compact examples, this is actually a finite dimensional vector space. For non-compact examples, one can sometimes get infinite dimensional spaces. So yeah, in its ordinary string theory, there's many, many more string states. In the B model, it's much smaller. Both in the B model should be finite on a compact example, singular on a non-singular compact example. If you prefer, I think that's the same as homologically smooth. And for non-compact things, things can go wrong, but they go wrong in mild ways. So, good. Sorry? Oh, sorry. Finally, we can compute disk amplitudes, and this gives us superpotentials of the theory. So these are the main things that are useful about the B module for us. I want to maybe add one in parentheses. So the goal of this talk, however, is to hide as much of this as possible. And actually, I mean, I think so, you know, what's going to come is going to be a lot of sort of math theorems and things like that. But I think one of the things history of the subject has shown is that as we learn things better, we've seen understood the connection to physics a lot better. And a lot of times, you know, just sort of by starting out and slavishly following the mathematics literature, it sort of led in wrong directions. And so it would really be good to understand these things much better from the point of view of physics. About three? Yes. So what I mean by that, and maybe I'll say more in a quick second, is that I can write down a boundary coupling for any, you know, D-brain you want. And so I will basically, if you give me a super vector bundle and a type of super connection on it, that is the same thing as a D-brain in the B-model. And so it's very explicit. There's no sort of triangulated categories, you know, hiding in there. And so so we really understand it on the world sheet now, and that's what I meant by that. I mean, you still have to, I mean, I don't know if there's any particular order that you can list these things in, but. But that does segue a little bit into some propaganda I would like to spend a few moments talking about. And this will be the only time in the talk I will mention the derived category. So this is an object in mathematics. This goes back to Groth and Deacon-Verdier to have lots of fun with homological algebra. And in the early 90s, Kontsevich made an inspired guess that this thing describes all the D-brains in the B-model. And, you know, this seemed pretty useful. So, you know, he's having the formulation of homological mirror symmetry. And so there's a lot of attempts in the physics literature to understand, you know, why are these the B brains in the B model? And so people started talking about tachyon condensation. And there was, I mean, there's a lot of really, you know, good things by Douglas and Aspinwall. Albion, I think, had Aspinwall-Morris and Diaconescu. But there was still an element of hand-waviness to them. And as I was just making the point is, that's not true anymore. We can really write down explicit world sheet boundary couplings that give us all the same information as this. And it's just physics. I mean, there's just, you know, you do the BRST variations, you can calculate everything. And it's not as scary as it used to be. This isn't a nonlinear signal model, yeah. Maybe I should list some names for who are that. There's the tome by Herbst, Torrey, and Page. It's also in an appendix to Kapustin, Rozansky, and Salina, and by myself. Right. So, I mean, at Landau-Ginzburg points, there is a, I would say, pretty well understood world sheet formulation of things in terms of what's called matrix factorizations. In the linear sigma model, I confess I haven't made it through this paper yet, but I would expect there is a lot of interesting things in there. Yeah. they're trying to do this for the linear sigma model. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, well, so, I mean, but you could ask now, if someone were to give you a, you know, Landau-Ginzburg-y type theory, what are the D-brains in it? I mean, so what I'm saying is we have an explicit world sheet sort of description of them for the nonlinear sigma model, and we also do for the Landau-Ginzburg point, and you can prove they're equivalent. But you might ask then, you know, why does this derived category structure, whatever it may be, why is it arising in all these different things? What does it describe the physics? And we actually understand that now, too. So what happens is, must obey a number of consistency conditions. And these consistency conditions arise because these states are related to differential forms in the moduli space of curves. But more importantly, we can glue world sheets together. There are gluing rules for world sheets, and you can describe amplitudes by cutting and sewing. And for the case of the topological B model, this is really well understood now, in particular due to the work of Getzler, Siegel, Costello, and Lurie. So these Getzler and Siegel sort of axiomatized what these consistency relations have to be. Costello really just sort of got down and tore apart the moduli space of curves and figured out how all these things have to fit together. And that's sort of a complete axiomatization of what these consistency relations must be. And you can show that the derived category, or things like the derived category, exactly satisfy these consistency conditions. So let's see, where am I now? So that's actually, I should say, it's actually not quite the derived category. There's a lot of stuff in the physics literature where they talk about triangulated categories. And it's actually understood now that that's sort of a bad notion. It's there's something called an enhanced derived category, and that's really the right notion. And that, in fact, is exactly the thing that satisfies these consistency conditions. So that's the end of my propaganda. I just want to try to hopefully maybe convince you a little bit that this isn't quite as scary as it comes out to be. And it's really, there's been a lot of work that's been made, progress that's been made in connecting this sort of, you know, mathematics that goes back, that was invented for completely different reasons, to the physical structures that we all know and love. Basically, if you keep straight the disk amplitudes. So the derived category throws away all the disk amplitudes. It just keeps track of this vector space of strings between two brains. Or if you prefer, it keeps track of the DG structure, that on each of this vector space, it actually arises because you're looking at the cohomology of a BRST-like operator. So you can either keep track of this complex, this DG structure, or you can keep in track of the A-infinity structure, which describes the disk amplitudes. Yes, so the axioms of a triangulated category don't include this A-infinity structure. What you really want to do is include the A-infinity structure, and if you want to be particularly pedantic about it, Jacob Lurie has a good description of these as stable infinity one categories, which is sort of really the right structure, but I don't think anybody wants to see what that is. So, I mean, if you know Bondel and Kapranov, they talk pre-triangulated. It's basically the analog of pre-triangulated. But what turns out is that, so a triangulated category, you're adding a bunch of extra structures to it. So you have to add this notion of distinguished triangles and, you know, tetrahedral axioms. What stable means is actually it's not extra structures. It's just some properties that it's some certain pushouts and pullback squares have to coincide. And from that, you can derive the triangulated structure on the homotopy category. But that's getting pretty far into the mathematics. So we can talk about it later if you want. No. The physicists had the A-infinity structure, and the mathematicians were sort of throwing it away for years, but they should have been keeping it. I'm talking about just the spectrum of string states in the D model. I'm not making any comment about. On the physical string, some of these D brains aren't even there. I would worry about not. I mean, certainly all I'm ever going to be computing eventually will be chiral multiplets. So, I mean, if you look at, so what Douglas does in the paper is he actually sort of writes down some vertex operators and computes their masses. I'm eventually just going to be computing some chiral multiplets. I should probably get back to you. I'm not entirely sure. I have a great answer for that, but let's see. Good. So, now that I'm done with the propaganda, you're still probably asking, what is this good for? I've just told you that you can do things that. The point is, we can use this to actually calculate things that we would not be able to calculate in other ways. So how are we going to do this? Well, I want to introduce a notion of something which I will call generating brain. So, we'll call a brain generating if it has strings, again, when I mean strings in the D model, to all other D brains. I have no physical intuition for you for this definition. This is coming from a math theorem. I think understanding these things from the point of view of physics is, I think, one of the unsolved problems in this area. I mean all of the topological D model string states. So that's all ghost numbers and things like that. I'm just talking on, from the point of view of the world sheet, I have a vector space, and it's graded by ghost number, and I want all of that whole vector space to be. Sorry, I didn't. Right, but I'm talking, as I said, I'm talking about states in the topological D model. I'm not making any reference to the physical string at the moment. I mean, so certainly things, brains which are disconnected, then they're not going to have, be careful. The support, can you have higher X groups between things whose support don't overlap? Probably not, no, yeah. But there are, these higher ghost number states, I wasn't going to write it, but there's this formula that Douglas wrote down. So from that point of view, these do does include some massive states from the point of view of the physical string. So. Good, okay. Massive states. I should say, by the way, that this definition, because I'm sort of copying slavishly a math definition, involves some very weird brains. In fact, particularly, it involves infinite stacks of brains and things like that. Another notion that's equivalent is you could say a brain is generating if, from the point of view of the B model, every other brain is some sort of component in the bound state of just collections of this brain. So now we'll define a tilting brain. So again, we have this vector space of topological strings from this brain to itself. It's a tilting brain, it's a generating brain such that you only have things ghost number zero. Again, I wish I had some physical intuition for you. It's a strange definition, but it will prove very useful. So these things are not too hard to find, just some examples. If we're just looking at C3, which is non-singular, tilting brain is just 1D brain filling the whole space, which I'll write as O. If you look at the conifold, or the resolved conifold, then we have the object which is two brains wrapping the entire conifold, one with a certain gauge field on it. Tachyons, usually. For the chirals, it becomes tachyons. For the vectors, it becomes massless. And I was trying to get this straight in my head before the talk, and I probably don't, so. But this is in this original paper by Douglas on n equals 1 categories. Okay. Good. I should say also that these things are much easier to find than these things. In particular, if we're on a compact Clabiao, there's ser-duality, which actually means none of these things exist. So you need to be in non-compact Clabiaos for this to be able to find these. But there exist lots of examples in the math literature, so we're lucky that way. Let's say we have our brain E. We can look at all the strings that go from E to itself. Now we can multiply these. We just concatenate. If we have two strings from E to itself, we can just sort of go around here, then go around here. That gives us a string from E to itself. So transforms in algebra, which I'll write as ND. Actually, just for technical reasons, I usually want to consider the opposite algebra, but that's not the point I'm going to not talk about. And the other weird thing I want to get too much into is that these states generally look like functions on the thing. And we only want to look at algebraic functions. So for example, on C3, this would just be polynomials in three variables. Wouldn't include things like exponentials and stuff like that. Again, unfortunately, something I don't have a good physics intuition for, but it's necessary. Good. So we're going to make use of a black box from the math literature called derived Mérite equivalence. But what this will let us do is take D-brains in terms of the geometry and turn them into representations of this algebra. And it's not too hard to understand how it works. Let's say we have a brain B here. We have strings stretching from E to B. So there's some vector space of strings stretching from E to B. Now, if I give you a string from E to itself, well, I can just go around this and then act on B again. So that gives us another string from E to B. So this vector space of strings from E to B is a representation of this algebra. And sort of when you soup that up in the right ways, it gives you a map between D-brains and technically complexes of representations of this algebra. And it turns out that there's a map in the other direction, and that this is an equivalence. I'm sorry? Yeah. So, I mean, what I've done is I've chosen a tilting brain on the Clabiac cone, and I've given some examples right there of tilting brains. Given any cone and any tilting brain, I can do this thing, and it's a theorem that everything works. For most of the examples, so certainly for all the cones over Delpezzo's, examples are known. Yes, exactly. So generally the way one does this is calls your friendly neighborhood mathematician, and they've computed lots of examples for you, often under the name exceptional collections. But, I mean, it's still, you know, you have to find these things. And that's one of the things you just need to do to follow this procedure. I will try to argue later that something like this will have to exist whenever there is a, you know, gauge theory at a for D-brain at a singularity, but I don't have really good arguments for that. Yeah, so that's this black box. This black box requires generating and tilting. Yeah, but you want it to be an equivalence. You want to say that for any brain you get a representation, but you also want to be able to go the other direction. And you want this to be, yeah. Exactly. So I should say, just as an aside, because this isn't as sort of well-known in the physics community, there is a version of this theorem where you drop the tilting condition. So there's a version of this for compact Calabi-Yau's. Life's a little bit harder, but it's not completely impossible. Actually, the other thing I want to say is, which hopefully if I have time I'll be able to get to, while, you know, this notion of generating brains and tilting brains seems very physically abstruse, this equivalence at the end, I think I have a guess for what the physical interpretation of being able to go back and forth from representations to brains, and I'll hopefully talk about that at the end. Good. So you have a vector space of string states, and the B model gives you this vector space. Yeah, I mean, so the way I've done it in my paper on sort of the subject is you just sort of try to find all the open string vertex operators that you can sort of stick on the boundary between, you have a boundary coupling which describes the brain, and you want to classify these open string vertex operators. But because you know topological theory, you have this BRST operator, and so the physical states are the cohomology of the BRST operator, and this vector space arises as a cohomology in that way. Yeah, so like in this example here, I sort of write, it's a sum of two brains. I mean, that's, you can, as I say, you can turn this right into abstruse mathematics. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's. Yeah, so that for, if there were higher Gauss number ones, then life would be a little more complicated and you'd be computing, cohomology groups. But for the Gauss number zero, everything is just, functions and sections of bundles and things like that. Okay. So now here's sort of the miraculous fact, is I've given you this algebra, and I'm now going to write this algebra for you in terms of a quiver. And so I'm just going to choose, again, cartoon. And so given a quiver like this, which is just a bunch of dots and arrows, you can form what's called its path algebra, which is exactly what you might think. You take all the paths in the quiver. The multiplication is concatenation of paths. If two paths don't sort of start and end at the same node, then they just multiply to zero. The only extra thing is you have to add an extra zero length arrow at each node that squares to itself, so it's sort of a projection operator. And in fact, as Dave was saying, these generating brains usually are splitting, have sums of different brains, and each element in that sum corresponds to a node in the quiver. So we also have a superpotential, W. So we impose the relations that for all arrows, we take the derivative of the superpotential with respect to an arrow. So we just, this is a loop. We remove an arrow, we get some sum of paths. We set this equal to zero. Exercise. So the reason why this algebra is important is that a point in the Masonic moduli space of the gauge theory is actually the same thing as a representation of this algebra. And you can think of this as imposing the F term equations. And I'm setting all the D terms equal to zero. I'm sorry? So I mean, I'm trying to avoid the issue of the D terms here. So yeah, but there definitely exist other representations of the gauge theory. Let's see. They're a little more difficult to describe. I mean, so the baryonic branches are very interesting to describe, but it's not quite as easy as this right here. But I mean, eventually, you know, we want when to compute the gauge theory moduli space, one wants to do some sort of GIT quotient. So you're going to get rid of the stackiness that way. So just as an example, so we start out with a C3. We have our generating brain, which is just functions on C3. So we just have polynomials in three variables. This is the algebra here, is just the polynomials in three variables. So let's draw one dot, call this arrow x1, call this arrow x2, call this arrow x3. We know these all commute, so the superpotential that gives that is epsilon ijk, xi, xj, xk, and this quiver probably seems familiar to most of you. So we're getting close. I've given you what looks like a way to go from one of these generating brains and tilting brains to something that looks a lot like a quiver gauge theory. But I haven't done what I wanted to do, and given you the fractional brains, and I haven't computed the string states between them to get show you that this is the right quiver. Yeah. Right. So what? No. This is algebra right now. I've not connected it. I haven't explained to you that this really is the right answer. But all this came from was taking this brain O on C3, which is non-compact brain filling the whole space. Well, whatever you want. But yeah, so generating brains always are supported everywhere. The x's here, right now all I've said is that the x's are, if you want sort of math language, right? What is this? This is functions on C3. So this is all I'm doing is giving you a fancy way of writing down polynomials in three variables. The path algebra of this quiver with this superpotential is just polynomials in three variables. Not yet. Right now, I've just sort of given you a weird recipe of starting with one of these tilting brains to get a quiver. Now, eventually, I want to get there, but it's going to be in a different way. So let's see, I have about 10 minutes left. Okay, good. So what I'd like to do now is tell you, using this recipe, how to find the fractional brains that the point-like brain, which you were talking about, is marginally stable to sort of decay into at the singularity. And what we'll use is our intuition that so we just know from our experience with fractional brains that if we add them to the geometry, they add one to the rank of the gauge group. And so I'm just going to write for you a very simple representation of a quiver for you. So given a quiver in the node I, take a one to given by everything else is zero. So this is a very simple representation of the quiver. It's associated with a node. And the claim is that this is a fractional brain. What we're using now is this equivalence I set up. I said we could go from brains to representations, Well, now here, I'm starting with a very simple representation, and you can work through this whole machinery and turn it back into a brain. But there's no reason to do that. I mean, since everything's equivalent, we might as well just work with this representation because it's nice and simple. So, now I want to prove to you that these really are the fractional brains. And the way we do that is we take the D3 brain, which is now a point-like brain at the singularity, and I want to show that it can decay into these brains. So this is something that goes a bit beyond the B model, because decay is covered by Kähler moduli, and the B model doesn't see that. But it turns out that there are consistency conditions for decays. In fact, Douglas called this pi stability. So if a decay can occur, it has to occur in special ways and satisfy these consistency conditions that Douglas wrote down and then Bridgeland formalized. And you can show that this decay is consistent with all the consistent relations that Douglas wrote down. So we started with this tilting brain. We start with a cone. Right. So the quiver is given by this strings from the tilting brain to itself. And that's an algebra. And what I'm telling you without proof is that algebra is always given by the path algebra of a quiver. Yeah, quiver with superpotential. Well, I mean, the superpotential is just describing the relations in the algebra. No. All you need to do is construct the tilting object, and then you calculate this algebra of endomorphisms. No, the algebra itself is just the strings from the tilting object to itself. The other brains are this way you go from brains to representations of this algebra. And what I'm telling you, sort of without proof, is that this algebra you get from the strings on the tilting brain is always given by a quiver with a superpotential. I'm not sure I understand the question. So you do know all the B brains on the cone. We know them. This tilting brain is just a very special brain that gives us a new way to describe the brains on the cone. And if you're given this tilting brain, we're now said that not only can we describe D brains in terms of the geometry of the cone, we can also describe them in terms of representations of this algebra. So it's sort of... Right, we're finding a new and hopefully simpler way to describe D brains on the cone, or B brains, to be a little more precise. And so this is making our life easier, even though we've sort of detoured through a lot of mathematics. In the end, it's a lot easier to deal with representations of an algebra than it is to deal with coherent sheaves. Right, exactly. And in fact, in the last 5 minutes, I'm going to say how this works. No. Right, and so I'll get to that in a second. Or perhaps cybergdual. sometimes there's cybergdual. Okay, good. So furthermore, actually, each of these fractional brains, if you think of it as just a point-like object in the non-compact four dimensions, is some BPS state. It has a central charge, which, you know, will be some complex number. And basically what happens is this decay can happen when these central charges all have the same phase. So now we get to Shamet's point that there exists different tilting brains, and they give rise to different collections of fractional brains. So what is the meaning of this? Well, at a given point in the Kähler moduli space, only one set of fractional brains will generally align. The other ones will be very out of alignment. So these different set of fractional brains correspond to different regions in the Kähler moduli space of the theory. And a lot of times these regions will actually abut. So you can sort of, as one of these things goes off the upper half plane, you can do a Seiberg duality and get back to a different quiver. So these are often related by Seiberg duality. I don't know if it's always true they're related by Seiberg duality. I don't know, maybe David knows the answer to this. Well, in fact, which I won't have time to get into, you can actually show that, the Masonic moduli space of these quivers is always the same. So, okay, so, good. I've given you the fractional brains. What did we want to do? So we want to compute the mass of strings between them and the superpotential. So generally, these fractional brains, I should say, are always located on sort of the resolution of the singularity. They're not these non-compact things anymore. They're located here. And what's nice is there's a theorem that we're done. To compute the massless string states between them, they're exactly the arrows in the quiver we wrote down. And we can compute the superpotential by calculating disk amplitudes. And it's exactly the superpotential we had here. So we started out getting this quiver in a very weird way, as sort of strings on this generating brain. We see that it gives us a set of fractional brains, and we can now calculate the quiver just using the fractional brains by computing the massless string states and the superpotential. We're done. That's it. So once I've given you, there's one for each node on the quiver, and that's the collection of them. Now, the collection of fractional brains that the D3 brain decays into will sometimes have two or three copies of the same fractional brain. I'll just leave it at that. Yes? Right. Yep. Well, so in a perfectly smooth space would be this example of C3. That's a perfectly smooth space. Yeah. There are just five brains wrapping the cycles. You can actually do that explicitly. You can take the Douglas-Moore and fit it into this whole paradigm and really calculate the fractional brains using this thing, and you see that you do exactly get, five brains wrapping the cycles and the resolved singularity. Right. Exactly. The point of view here is that if we just focus on these holomorphic things and do the B model, the resolved geometry is the same as the singular geometry. And we can actually work with the resolved geometry when we really can't generally understand the singular geometry. So we're trying to understand the singular geometry by computing things in the resolved geometry that don't depend on the resolution. Well, there isn't. The fractional brain is the D3 bean itself. It just doesn't decay into anything. But it still works. I mean, we got n equals 4 Yang mils out of it, right? That's pretty good, you know. So you want to check, you know, the very first example. It's important. So let me just end maybe with a little bit of a rampant speculation here. So this equivalence I talked about isn't just a map between brains and representations. It's actually much stronger than that. It says that anything we can calculate in the B model, so not just the brains, but the string states, the superpotentials, even closed string scattering, or not even closed string amplitudes possibly, though this is maybe a little sketchier, are all calculable in terms of the quiver. So, you know, we have geometry, and we have algebra. So, you know, the quiver is the gauge theory. And then we have the B model, the nonlinear sigma, which is geometry. And I'm telling you that, you know, this crazy math theorem tells us that anything we can compute over here, we can compute over here. I don't know. It sort of sounds like gauge geometry duality to me somehow. So I spent a couple years trying to see if I could make that precise, and unfortunately didn't really get anywhere. But I think this, I don't know. I mean, I'm wondering, is this some sort of like topological residual of, you know, the full gauge geometry duality? I mean, one difference is, of course, that the geometry here is not 5 cross, you know, M5, it's the cone. But that's not, they're not so different. I'm sorry? Right now, because I'm being rampantly speculative, I'm just, the statement I can make is that anything I can calculate, any B model calculation on this resolved cone, I can translate for you into something to do with this quiver. I mean, I don't think that's relevant for what I'm saying. I mean, so yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, the only statement I want to make, because I want to be very careful, the only statement I want to make is that B model calculations over here can be translated into some quiver calculations over here. I leave the interpretation of this statement to the audience. Not easily. I mean, there are certainly going to be quivers which don't, you know, give any geometry at all. The easiest thing you could do is calculate a Smithsonic moduli space and start with that. Another thing, there was a conjecture by David that you could actually look at the center of this quiver algebra, and that would be functions on the cone. I can prove for you, using this whole apparatus, that if I start from a cone and get a quiver that way, then David's conjecture holds. Okay, maybe I should. That's a very good question. That was going to be here as my list of future directions. So there's this wonderful toric machinery that Ami and company have developed. So I think there's been some work in the math side that have tried to sort of come up with a relation here. And I know Paul has been working on sort of finding, you know, describing D brains on toric varieties and things like that. Maybe you know the answer. I don't know if this connection has really been filled out. So Herzog and Ami and they. So there was some speculations on going from toric things to tilting brains, but there was a lot of conjecture. As far as I know, you weren't able to prove in general that this worked, right? I mean, but I think there should be some connection. What's nice about this procedure here is that you know the fractional brains. I can write them down for you explicitly. And the calculation of the gauge theory is really just computing string states between fractional brains. Oh, sorry. Sorry? I mean, the question is can you relate them to, I mean, show that it really comes from a tilting object? I would sort of direct that to Ami. I mean, so in every example where you can do both, you get the same answer? But I mean, what we're calculating the gauge theory on the D3 brain by calculating the fractional brains, the B brains on the singularity. That's how that is the paradigm. You know, we're using to calculate the answer to that question. What is the thing on these brains? In the process, we learned a lot of other things, but that was that's the goal. I can make one last quick comment and then I will finish up. Okay. So maybe since I don't have time to get into it in detail, but I want to make the argument actually that this equivalence here between this geometry and algebra should hold in all situations when the gauge theory, to describe the gauge theory on the D3 brain. And the way I want to argue that this is true is that you could take this gauge theory in four dimensions, compactify it down to two dimensions, and think of it as sort of a gauge linear model on the world sheet. I've told you now, and it's a theorem, that the Masonic moduli space of this theory is exactly the original cone we started with, and so you should be able to describe brains in the IR limit, which hopefully is the sigma model, by something in terms of the gauge theory upstairs. And you can, I've done some calculations, though nothing really solid yet, to show that those brains described in terms of the gauge theory are described in terms of representations of the quiver. And so this should be some sort of RG flow. It should be a physical explanation for this equivalence. Sorry? I think for the Masonic branch, no, but I won't be completely confident with that answer. This is very, very speculative. I haven't really worked this out to any significant extent. Okay, thank you. All right.
So if I want to have both D3 and D7,
just for some crazy reason.
Presumably, just to be explained, but for P27, it can't be
pretty good. Yeah, I mean, anything NS5 brains in the B model, maybe someone knows how to do it, but I certainly don't. Yeah, I mean, these are all correspond to, BPS, B brains, and the false physical string. So O-planes are a more interesting question. So there does exist a kind of topological description of O-planes. I don't remember the names off the top of my head, where you can try to calculate superpotentials. And I think I don't know if it's been done, but it should be possible to work out the orientable version of the story. All right, thank you.